From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. We're here. Brian Kilmeade Show coming your direction. We close out the week with Dr. Marty McCary, FDA commissioner. That'll be great. Daniel Hoffman is standing by, former CIA station chief. I've served in Moscow, Iraq, and Pakistan, as well as South Asia and Europe. I got to talk to him about Iran, the new revelations in the Wall Street Journal today that they're looking to buy major ballistic missiles and the sales complete from China. I mean, how much longer do you think that Israel is going to wait for the missiles to be assembled in Iran before they sit on the side? How much longer are we going to wait for Steve Witkoff to work out some type of real estate deal, or excuse me, some peace treaty deal with or nuclear deal with Iran before we move ahead? I just think this whole thing has just been a colossal waste of time. I don't think Steve Witkoff has an experience doing this, and I think it shows. The President of the United States came out and said, when it comes to Russia and Ukraine, I think it's time just to let these guys keep on fighting. So that's interesting. I'd love to see the president come down with some Russian sanctions, because you got Ukraine to the table. You didn't get Russia. And everybody's talking about this, literally everybody, the fallout between Trump and Musk, everything, it's got so personal. Musk came out and said basically Trump's on Epstein's list. Pretty amazing that you'd say something so irresponsible, even when you lose your temper. He's obviously against the big, beautiful bill. He calls it the big, ugly bill and will increase the deficit by $2.5 trillion. Other people that actually sit and read the bill feel totally different about it. And I think it'll actually help it move it forward and make it a better bill for now. Elon Musk later, after getting personal, talking about the tariffs. There was some hope of a de-escalation after we're going to have to Thune too, as well as Johnson. Bill Ackman put out on Truth Social, on X, said, "I support Donald Trump and Elon Musk. They should make peace for the benefit of our great country. We are much stronger together than apart." And Musk's direct response was to Ackman, "You're not wrong." So, to me, sometimes people lose their temper, or they drink too much, or they do something illogical. But this went on for hours. So I just think it's just totally irresponsible. And believe it or not, I thought President Trump was very much in check during the whole thing. Now, on the serious stuff, when it comes to Ukraine and Russia, I love the military operation. When 113 to 117 drones were deployed, when trucks opened up, when roofs opened up inside Russia, bridges were blown up, trains were derailed, and military bases and planes were hit. Then they followed up by exploding a bridge underwater, the bridge that links Crimea with Russia. Love it. More is to come. Joining us now is Daniel Hoffman. Dan, welcome back.
Thanks, Brian. Great to be on the program, and hope everybody has a great weekend in spite of the not-so-great news on the national security front.
Right. So let's talk about what President Trump said. I mean, he just comes out and says, "I think it's best if these guys just continue to fight it out." He said, "Sometimes you're on a playground and you just let these guys punch their way out." Cut 42.
When I see the moment where it's not going to stop, and I'm sure you're going to do the same thing, will be very, very, very tough. And it could be on both countries, to be honest. You know, it takes two to tango. But we're going to be very tough, whether it's Russia or anybody else. We're going to be very tough.
I don't know what that means, but what do you think?
Well, the president's right about one thing, and that is that wars end when one side wins or both sides are too exhausted to fight, or potentially when, in one case, maybe the population rises up and decides that they don't want to support the war effort. Obviously, that's not going to happen in Russia. But this war is on Russia. Putin launched the invasion. He has been mounting indiscriminate attacks on Ukrainian civilians in their homes and hospitals, neighborhoods, and maternity wards. And Ukraine is defending themselves in what is an existential fight for their survival. Now, we can definitely make the war end sooner, in my opinion, if we were to implement those sanctions and continue to ensure that Ukraine is the necessary arms that they need. They could pay for them. Europe can pay for them. That and intelligence support. Make sure that Putin understands that the longer he carries on the war, the greater price he's going to pay. Now, I don't think Putin is going to stop fighting, but I do believe that his military, his senior national security officials and intelligence officers are going to understand the risks that they're taking by carrying out the war. That's what we've got to show Vladimir Putin. And then by extension, to get to what some of the other issues you were talking about, make this war a loser so you break the relationship between Russia and Iran, Russia and China, Russia and North Korea. That's the axis of dictatorships. And the best way to break it is by showing those evil countries that their relationship with Putin is not going to be a winner for them.
I just don't understand. I just hope that we continue to give them weapons, which I don't think we are. Here is Dave Ignatius of Washington Post, Cup 47.
President Trump's, to me, sadly, has now stepped back from this conflict. There was a lot of hope when he became president that he would be the peacemaker. He'd find a way to put enough pressure on Russia to get Russia and Ukraine to terms that might lead to a stable settlement. Well, we saw this week with the meeting between the two negotiators in Istanbul that they're so far apart that a negotiated settlement isn't possible. And Trump is now characterizing this as a fight between kids on a playground, in effect. I mean, you got to let them keep fighting. That's bad news for Ukraine.
I know the Europeans are stepping up, and the Germans said that we're going to be able to give them rockets that are going to go further distance into Russia. So this new chancellor really is pro-Ukraine.
He's pro-Europe, too, Brian. This is very much in Europe's self-interest. It's in our interest. We enjoy $2 trillion worth of trade with Europe, and the last thing we want is for Russia to cast their shadow over Eastern Europe and the rest of the continent by subjugating Ukraine, which is what Vladimir Putin is trying to do. I mean, look, it's the moral and ethical right thing to do for us to support Ukraine, but we all have our own self-interest here. Vladimir Putin has launched a brutal invasion, the likes of which we haven't seen since World War II on that continent. And everything we can do to stop it and get a peace deal that ensures Ukraine is going to be a sovereign, independent country going forward, that's what our policy should be. And Russia's terms that they sought to impose on Ukraine at those Istanbul negotiations just indicate that the Kremlin wants Ukraine to be a part of Russia. It's what they've always wanted, and Ukraine's not going to let that happen. Russia doesn't even control the Donbass, and they wanted Ukraine to give up territory that Russia doesn't even control yet as part of a settlement.
Yeah.
Not going to happen.
And also commit to not having an army, which is not going to happen,
yep.
Having a 9,000-person force that is mostly police. That's not going to happen. They also don't want NATO forces or European forces inside Ukraine as a tripwire. So that's not going to happen either. I want to fast forward over to Iran. Grand Ayatollah said no deal. We want to continue to enrich uranium and spin centrifuges. What's there to talk about?
Well, the real problem with this iteration of a Iran nuclear deal is that it's being discussed, debated in the public square. I'm not sure that does any of us any good where we give a play-by-play of how things are going. I know it's fun and interesting for us in the media, but it's not necessarily helpful or conducive to good negotiations. The Ayatollah is playing to his own base and to the negotiations writ large. He's trying to kind of prepare the battle space, so to speak, and ensure that that Iran gets nothing worse than what they got for the JCPOA, which is allowed them to enrich uranium up to 3%. So, look, I'm not that sanguine that we're going to get to a deal. Israel is locked and loaded and ready to launch on Iran if they feel like a deal isn't going to happen or if a bad deal is being proposed. And I think we need to be clear about that, too, that we are not going to allow Iran to enrich uranium. We're not going to allow Iran to have a nuclear program. And if it comes to it, we will launch a military attack on Iran. I know President Trump doesn't want another war in the Middle East, but you've got to have credible deterrence results from the strength of making a threat you intend to carry out if needed.
So Iran has ordered material from China for hundreds of ballistic missiles. That's in the Wall Street Journal today. Does that play into anybody acting or not acting?
I mean, there are three issues here that are a real concern for Iran. One is the nuclear program. We're trying to deal with that. But there are other two issues we are not dealing with right now. And this was a big criticism of the JCPOA from the incoming Trump administration in 2017, that the JCPOA did nothing to deal with Iran's ballistic missile capability and their support to proxy terrorists. So those are things you could either negotiate or you can deal with them kinetically. And that's the choice for President Trump and Secretary slash National Security Advisor Rubio and Secretary Hegseth and the rest of the team. What's also important, Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard's got to ensure that the intel community is mounting a full court press to collect intelligence on what Iran is doing behind the scenes with Russia, China, and North Korea. Those countries have all been nuclear proliferators. And then also Director of CIA Ratcliffe with CIA human sources on the ground in those countries, again, collecting on the threats that they pose to the region and to our homeland.
Here's what General Jack Keane said about the ballistic missiles, Cut 59.
When the Israelis attacked Iran in October, Iran reattacked, this time only with ballistic missiles. 200 ballistic missiles, 40 of them got through. That really worries the Israelis. Why? They had 11 minutes warning. They got all their airplanes off the deck. They got people into bunkers at those airfields. Iran only attacked military targets on the Mossad headquarters. If Iran attacks civilian population centers, like Tel Aviv, like Jerusalem, with 300, 400 ballistic missiles, that is going to be an issue. And the sooner we get this thing stopped with the Iranians once and for all, it's in Israel's interest, and it certainly is in the United States' national interest as well.
He's right. Final thought, Dan?
No, he's 100% right. Look, when it comes to dealing with dictators, you can't appease them. And you've got to deal with the threat now. It only gets worse with time, unfortunately. It's not like fine wine that we might enjoy on Father's Day that we're celebrating with our families. It just gets worse with age.
All right. Thanks so much, Daniel Hoffman. It's a moving situation. I feel like we're in hyperspace. I feel like we're all spinning our wheels with Iran, with Ukraine, with Gaza. And we all know what has to be done. We're just waiting to exhaust all options first.
And just one last thing, Brian, looming over all of this is Taiwan. China's watching to see how resolute we are, and they will factor that into whatever plans they have for Taiwan.
I hear you. Daniel Hoffman, thanks so much. 1-866-408-7669. First stops Virginia when we get back on the phones. Dr. Marty McCary, he's pushing forward at the FDA in a way that's shocking a lot of people. I am thrilled by it. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade.
As America prepares for its 249th birthday on July 4th, Fox News Podcasts celebrates great Americans, highlighting well-known and everyday folks who've made their mark on the country in their own special way. Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcasts.com.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Elon and I had a great relationship. I don't know if we're well anymore. I was surprised because you were here. Everybody in this room practically was here as we had a wonderful send-off. He said wonderful things about me. You couldn't have nicer. Said the best thing. He's worn the hat. Trump was right about everything. And I am right about the great, big, beautiful bill. We call it a great, big, beautiful bill because that's what it is.
So, and then they had this big meltdown where he accused him being on Epstein's list. He said that the spending is going to bankrupt the whole country. I have a lot of emails coming in about this. This is from Mike. Mike says, the first thing you must be said about the Trump must disagreement is that both men are correct and both men are totally wrong. It also must be said, however, that no Democrat in the world and no other two men could have accomplished more in 4.5 months than these two. Both of them are brilliant leaders. Each has strengths and qualities that are not compared to any person on the planet Earth. I'll add to something else. John Fetterman weighed in. Democrats are loving this, but do you think that he wants anything to do with you, or you have any credibility actually siding with Musk? Because you basically are blowing up his cars, trying to destroy his company, laughing when his rockets have problems. Here's Senator John Fetterman, who gets it. Cut 10.
It's like I've been saying, you know, the Dems we've been dumping all over Musk and vandalizing Teslas or whatever, and now suddenly now we might be more back into him and thing. It's just like it's a thing. It's like, you know, he's right about the big, beautiful bill. I mean, it's like adding a $2.5 trillion debt. I mean, it's astonishing.
Well, number one, I found out from the White House, Trump is not calling. So if there's going to be any outreach, it's not coming from Trump. And I don't think he should at all call him. Here's Newt Gingrich, cut 15.
Henry Ford didn't end up running the country. Thomas Edison didn't end up running the country. And in fact, in the end, Elon Musk is not going to end up running the country. So I think probably things will calm down over the next 2 or 3 days. Trump has a lot of really serious things to do. And placating Musk is probably down around number 27 on the list.
So now when it comes to the bill that really matters, and I mean that really matters, they're looking at other things to cut spending. Now, look, they're going to push back on the SALT deduction that gives states in high tax a chance to get a tax break. All right. They're going to revisit that. It's going to drive people like Lal and all these New Jersey congressmen, Republicans, crazy. But they're also going to look at Medicare, not just Medicaid, on Medicare. I just don't know how you can criticize the bill for being cutting Medicaid and then still criticize the bill on not cutting Medicaid. Will someone actually read the bill? It has verification twice a year on everybody and a work requirement for able-bodied people. What don't you understand about that? They're going to make sure that illegal immigrants don't get Medicaid or Medi-Cal. What don't you understand about that? That's really, you can't have it both ways. So when it comes to out to spending, they increase money on defense. Do you know anybody that doesn't think we need to increase defense spending? Make it more efficient? Absolutely. The redundancies in the program, please get that done. But we have to expand our industrial base to be able to supply our customers slash allies. That, to me, is a big deal. The spending bill matters. Chip Roy weighed in on the problems these two men are having and the bill that he kind of wrestled with and wasn't going to vote for it to the last second that's in the Senate right now. Cut 23.
You've talked about that. I've talked about that. Republicans should do more. We should be more aggressive. Elon is correct that we need to be doing more to meet the moment. But unfortunately, the way this is spilled out is ignoring a lot of the good work we've done. We do need to take a good the good things, add to them, get rid of some of the bad things. I hope the Senate will do that. And to answer your question, spent a lot of time with some good friends in the Senate last night, good friends like Mike Lee and Rick Scott and others. And, you know, they're saying a lot of the right things. I think that the majority leader understands the need that we need to make the bill better.
And that's what they're going to do. John Thune's going to do. He doesn't like a lot of the stuff that's in there, but that's a lot of the stuff that they like. So Dr. Marty McCary on that. So the bill does indeed matter. The other big story is Joe Biden. Now he's standing up saying, I was, even though I used the auto pen on every pardon except Hunter's, I still supported all of them, made all the decisions. And get this, Bill Clinton is still saying that Joe Biden was fine. Listen to him on The View yesterday, cut 28.
All I can say, we know Woodrow Wilson, after his stroke, couldn't make any decisions and his wife made them. Now, some people think that's best of both worlds. Get to what guy said it. Somebody else making the calls. But I mean, we're laughing about this. But it's, in my view, we should spend more time thinking about the future.
Well, you too. But you should follow, you not lie for 4 straight years, then look to just think about the future. And then you have the KJP come out and say, I'm going to be an independent because the White House I worked for was broken, even though she said the exact opposite. The hatred that's coming her direction from Democrats is mind-boggling, stunning, but not surprising. She has alienated herself so clueless, she actually thinks she's going to emerge as an independent hero. Forget it. Dr. Marty McCary on things that matter, just on getting cutting-edge drugs approved to finding out what we're eating.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
We are increasing Medicaid spending. And I'll give you a number. We project $200 billion of more money being spent on Medicaid. We already have a healthcare system that spends twice as much on individuals as any other system in the world. So the problem isn't money. The issue is the increased expenditures on Medicaid, which is 50% bigger than it was 5 years ago before the pandemic, is crippling the system. We are hurting Medicaid. The president said, and is very clear on this, he wants to love and cherish these programs. Our job is to save this system.
Yeah, that is Dr. Oz, who's trying to save Medicaid and Medicare. Now they're talking about some type of reform when it comes to Medicare, which was not going to be touched originally. Meanwhile, working away is his colleague, Dr. Marty McCary, great guest of the show, former Fox News contributor, now FDA commissioner. Dr. McCary, welcome back.
Great to be with you, Brian. Thanks.
What has been your focus from day one? I noticed you're not looking to color in the lines. You're looking to push the envelope and move this division forward. In what way?
Well, my goal is very simple. I wanted to see more cures and meaningful treatments delivered for the American people and healthier food for children, because we've got a disease epidemic and we can't just talk about insulin and Ozempic for kids. We've got to talk about school lunch programs and the SNAP program and all the chemicals that appear in our food supply. We also have to cut the red tape for our developers and inventors. The new therapies that are in the pipeline, Brian, are amazing. One of the cool things about being head of the FDA is I get to see the stuff that's in development, and it is amazing. Treatments for stage 4 cancers of certain types, childhood blindness, diabetes. So I want to see these cures come to market, and to do that, we have to insist on the scientific standards. We can't cut corners on that. But we have to ask big questions we've never asked before. Why does it take 10 years for a drug to come to market in the United States? Mm-hmm. We've got to challenge some deeply held assumptions.
So what program is going to push that? There's a name for a new program you have? If I have a medicine that I want, I have stage 4 cancer, I need it, it's still being developed, what can we do?
So we want to build on the successes of the accelerated review program,
yep,
the priority review program. And we want to right now we're doing this incredible analysis of how we can just cut the red tape, cut the steps, be in better communication with the developers of these drugs so they don't have to wait 2 months just to get a letter returned with a simple question. So we're looking at running continuous trials. We're looking at reducing animal testing. We made a big announcement on how we don't need animal testing for certain drugs now. We've got computational modeling. We've got laboratory cells that you can test drugs on that are more predictive sometimes. And some of these drugs are approved in Europe, and they've been on the market, and yet the FDA has still been requiring animal testing on these drugs. So it's like we're not using common sense. And one of our big themes is gold standard science and common sense.
Absolutely. Dr. McCary, I saw that RFK Jr. came out as HHS secretary and says, if medical schools don't start including nutrition, you're going to lose funding. When it comes to nutrition, you're focusing on baby formula. Remember, we had a crisis of baby formula when Joe Biden first took over. We couldn't get it. But you're looking at what's in it. You said it has not been modernized, really looked at since the 80s?
Since 1998. So for 26 years, we've had essentially no changes to the baby formula world because we have this crazy system where the FDA creates a recipe. I mean, basically, think about this. The government is telling you this is the recipe for baby formula, and they haven't touched it in 26 years, with the exception of adding selenium once. So we've had very little innovation. And so what happens is you get these supply chains that are dependent on certain companies at mass producing it. And what you don't have is competition, right? So we want to see more products come to market. Moms want baby formula with no seed oil. They want baby formula with no corn syrup. They want baby formula with no heavy metals. So we had a giant roundtable at the FDA 3 days ago, mm-hmm, where we brought in experts from around the world to talk about how we innovate and change this entire space so we can see more innovation and more products come to market.
And did something come out of it? And do you find that people are intrigued by your interest in everything going forward rather than going along?
Well, there are some folks at the FDA that say, wait a minute, this is how we've been doing it for decades, you know, or the FDA commissioner is never involved in these product-related matters. And, historically, this is not how we've done it. Well, it's a new day at the FDA. We have got to modernize the agency. We implemented AI-assisted scientific reviews this week across the agency. Over 5,000 scientific reviewers and other staff at the agency are using our AI-assisted review tools. to be able to go through these giant applications faster. And we're just doing a lot of common sense stuff, Brian, and my hope is that it delivers more meaningful treatments and cures for Americans.
Absolutely. So, you know, one thing I was struck by, and we were texting, I texted you, I just could not believe the hostility, your direction on Face the Nation, especially when something is logical, should you be getting COVID shot for kids? And I don't think they were prepared, but Margaret Brennan or anybody is prepared for the depth of knowledge that people on our channel, not just doctors on our channel, were forced to go deep under the pandemic. And people were questioning nonstop. On the other channels, it was just right, tell me what to do. It wasn't happening on Fox. Listen to this exchange. Well, let's relive this exchange with you and Margaret Brennan on vaccines and kids. Cut 66.
For 88% of American kids, their parents have said no to the COVID shot last season. So America, the vast majority of Americans are saying no. Maybe they want to see some clinical data as well. Maybe they have concerns about
safety. I don't want to crowdsource my health guidance. I want a clear thing,
the
right? You don't
thing,
go with popularity.
The worst
you go with,
thing,
as you're saying, data. And when we
yeah, so
at
let's
that
see
data,
the data.
Okay. So the CDC data said 41% of children aged 6 months to 17 years hospitalized with COVID between 2022 and 2024 did not have a known underlying condition. In other words, they looked healthy.
So,
and COVID was serious for them.
So, first of all, we know the CDC data is contaminated with a lot of false positives from incidental positive COVID tests with routine testing of every kid that walks in the hospital. When I go to the ICU, when I walk to the we know that data historically under the Biden administration did not distinguish being sick from COVID or an incidental positive COVID test. When you go to an ICU in America and you ask how many people are in the ICU that are healthy, that are sick with COVID, the answer I get again and again is we haven't seen that in a year or years.
So, Paul, so Dr. McCary, this is what we're talking about. You have these people hopping on television talking about all these kids in ICUs, and we're saying, who are these kids? They don't have underlying conditions. So where does the rubber hit the road on this conversation? What struck you most?
Well, look, I saw you. I think you saw the fear machine in full force
yes.
right there. Americans, the COVID emergency is over. 85% of healthcare workers said no to the COVID shot last year. Healthcare workers, Brian.
But she doesn't want to crowdsource her health. She doesn't want to crowdsource her health, Dr. McCary.
Well, I mean, what happened to listening to the scientists, right? That 85% of healthcare workers said no to the COVID booster last shot. Yeah. We wrote in the New England Journal of Medicine, the head of the vaccine center and myself wrote in the New England Journal of Medicine, our top journal, an evidence-based approach for vaccines in the for COVID vaccines. And we're just saying, look, it's been 4 years since a randomized controlled trial. If vaccines come to us for COVID at the FDA, we want to see a clinical trial showing a benefit. And in the meantime, we're not taking away vaccines for high-risk people or immunosuppressed folks where their doctor thinks it is reasonable. But we're getting back to science. We're not putting a blindfold on at the FDA and rubber stamping COVID shots every year without any clinical updated trial data. And so that's our approach. The government is not your doctor. And I think that's where some people want the government to be your doctor. But when the government is your doctor, it doesn't have a very good track record.
So what was your sense when you were sitting across from her? She looked so angry at you.
Well, they're all God's children, Brian. You know, I feel bad for folks that have just they're so deep in the Fauci camp that they can't possibly imagine a world where a young baby girl born today does not get 80 shots in her average 80-year lifespan. You know, people are just, they've bought this blind strategy. There's two thoughts with the COVID booster. The blind camp, which is, we don't need any clinical trial data for young, healthy kids. Just blindly give it to them every year without data. And the other camp, which is my camp, which is the evidence-based strategy that we outlined in the New England Journal of Medicine.
Here's the other argument. Of course, pregnant women shouldn't get COVID shots in 2025, but that doesn't resonate with her. Cut 67.
You published in the New England Journal of Medicine on May 20th, in that report you referenced, you listed pregnancy as an underlying medical condition that increases a person's risk for severe COVID. You said that. So then 7 days later, you joined in this video announcement saying you should drop the recommendation for the COVID vaccine in healthy pregnant women. So what changed in the 7 days?
In the New England Journal of Medicine, we simply list what the CDC has traditionally defined as high risk. And we're just saying it, decide with your doctor. We're not saying
but
one way or the other. And the randomized
data
trial.
Data and information as well from you and your.
So here's the data on pregnant women. A randomized control trial was set up and it was closed without any explanation. We wanted to see that trial complete so women can have information that in a randomized controlled trial, which is the gold standard, this is what the data shows. We don't have those data.
All right. It is still unclear what pregnant women now should do until they get the data that
I'd say talk to their doctor.
When do they get the data you're promising? All these controlled studies.
In the absence of data, they should talk to their doctor, and their doctor use their best wisdom and judgment.
FDA commissioner, thank you for trying to help clear this up.
I mean, absolutely despicable. Number one is you've been there 3 months. The study was stopped. So you're saying, well, I'm not going to come out with a conclusion on a study that wasn't completed. She's like, well, where's your study? It's June 1st.
I forgot about that exchange, Brian. I've been in the job about 9 weeks here as FDA commissioner. We put out an article and they go through it with a fine-tooth comb looking for anything. And meanwhile, in the Biden administration, it didn't matter if the medical establishment ignored natural immunity, closed schools for a year and a half, masked toddlers, vaccine mandates, or you lose your job. None of that got scrutiny or another point of view. But if we write an article in the New England Journal of Medicine, our top medical journal, and we include a list of risk factors from the CDC, she goes through and says, well, hey, you've got pregnancy listed as a risk factor, and gotcha. I'm saying it's up to you and your doctor. 13% of pregnant women got the COVID shot last year. What does that tell you? They don't want it.
Of course. But you don't want to crowdsource your information. Dr. McCary, it's the reality that's hitting Washington, and watching it in real time is so fascinating to me because you can't outthink you or outresource you. You've been through it. You do this every day. You don't just put on a lab coat and say, I have an idea. Let me just create some legislation. You're out there trying to figure it out while moving everything forward, and that seems to bother people.
They're really it's a sad commentary of how polarized our country became with this sort of absolutism of the public health establishment insisting you leave the military if you didn't have your COVID second shot, that you stop being a teacher, that you get fired as a firefighter. It became so toxic. And we're saying, look, we're not telling everyone you must get a COVID shot. Every 12-year-old girl in America must get her sixth shot. We're not saying that. And we're not saying the shots are going to be taken off the market. We're just taking an evidence-based approach in the middle, and we're saying talk to your doctor, and people go bananas on both sides sometimes.
And I just love the emphasis everywhere with RFK's team on nutrition, because it was like, go to a nutritionist or go to a doctor. Can you imagine if you can go to one? And they both had equal passion for what we eat and how your body responds. And then preventive medicine, stem cells, which is coming our way. I'm fascinated by what could happen with you guys in charge. Dr. Marty McCary, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brian. Good to be with you.
Yeah, you really appreciate it here, even if you're not there. Back in a moment.
Giving you everything you need to know. You're with Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
I must say I was afraid. I'm a foreigner. I don't have a green card. I'm not an American citizen. I'm fairly prominent. And I literally prepared to go to America as if I was going to North Korea. I took a burner phone, Jamie. Imagine that.
By the way, she was talking to her ex-husband, Jamie Rubin. That is Christine Amanpour. I don't know what country she's from, but she could stay there. She's on NPR, goes on CNN to rip Trump and rip Israel on a regular basis. She actually paints herself as a victim, of someone living outside the country. If they come here, Donald Trump will arrest you. Really? Donald Trump will arrest Christine Amanpour? Like we even care she exists? this self-important, sophisticated Rosie O'Donnell-like character really thinks that President Trump is going to go get her like Ellen. When Ellen left the country, I give her credit. Rosie, you left the country. That's great. George Clooney feels the same way. I don't know if we even pulled that soundbite. We do. Let's listen.
Do you worry about, I mean, personally being targeted by the administration?
Sure. Everybody worries about it. But, you know, if you spend your life worrying about things, then you won't do things. You know, we like everybody, have a family, we have a life, and we have, and we try to, you know, live and do the things as the best example for our kids. And I want to be able to look at my kids in the eye and say where we stood and what we did at certain times in history. And I have no problem with that.
But just know his wife is part of the court that wanted to see Benjamin Netanyahu arrested, along with the defense minister Gallant, and calls what's happening in Gaza genocide. And she's part of a world court that that despises Israel, and I imagine the United States. That's Amal Clooney. So the ICC's controversial Netanyahu decision, she's all over that. She's on the board. You're entitled to that. But George Clooney, I thought, was level-headed. I think he said something similar to after Kamala Harris lost, is, you know, we lost. Okay, we'll go back and win next time. But to his credit, he took the question from Anderson Cooper. He didn't set the table and said, I'm worried about this. But he did take the question. Yeah, everyone's got to be concerned. Yeah, Robert De Niro, all the credit, Michael Moore. Yeah, Donald Trump is coming for you. I don't think so. They're rounding up illegal immigrants, people that overstayed their visas. They're not going after TV personalities or actors. Pretty sure they're not. Anyway, okay? Quick note, History, Liberty, and Laughs, along with Fox Nation, will be on stage coming up for WHIO listeners especially. We're going to have special Ohio celebrity, in my view. We'll be there in studio and on the Victoria Theater June 21st on stage. Go to BrianKilmeade.com. VIP opportunities where I get a chance to talk to you off the record before the show and kind of preview everything. A lot of people choose to do that. That's an opportunity there. Then, of course, in Dallas, Texas, in August, and Richmond, Virginia in September.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With a message for everyone paying big wireless way too much. Please, for the love of everything good in this world, stop. With Mint, you can get premium wireless for just $15 a month. Of course, if you enjoy overpaying, no judgments, but that's weird. Okay, one judgment. Anyway, give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan, equivalent to $15 per month required. Intro rate first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See full terms at mintmobile.com.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. Brian Kilmeade coming your way from Midtown Manhattan, heard around the country, around the world. Had a chance to host Long Island University's big gala last night. Thanks to everybody who came out and gave to that great university. I think it's a little biased because I went there, but if you look at the Roosevelt School, the School of Democracy, you see the vet school that just started. They went Division I. It's very hard to find a university more on the upswing than LIU. And, of course, the most famous person from LIU is Ray Dalio, maybe America's premier investor in the world, and went there and got a business degree. This hour, we're going to be joined by Senator Mark Wayne Mullen, bottom of the hour of Oklahoma. And we're going to talk to Andrew Weiss shortly, Vice President of Studies at Carnegie for International Peace in Washington, a real Russia expert. And we need that. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
I think what bothers me about this is it seems like she was in the White House for her own personal gain, that she had a publicist working for her pro bono to lift up her profile. When you're in government service, you're not supposed to worry about your own personal profile.
I didn't think so either. That's a CNN reporter pointing that out. Biden world absorbs another body blow, even though it's from a lightweight KJP. Why I think it still keeps Dems off course and allows the GOP some open field running.
Number two.
It creates economic growth, which if the Congressional Budget Office wasn't a bastion of idiotic left-wing thinking, by itself, the economic growth would virtually pay for the bill. You know, Musk probably ought to get a briefing on the real bill rather than his personality feelings.
That is true, Newt Gingrich. The BBB still moves ahead. Why I believe the turbulence with Musk will make the overall package better.
Number one.
But I'm very disappointed because Elon knew the inner workings of this bill better than almost anybody sitting here, better than you people. He knew everything about it. He had no problem with it. All of a sudden, he had a problem.
Yep. He came back and said he didn't have a problem. The must Trump goes from meltdown to truce. But how much damage was done personally and politically, we'll discuss. Look, it doesn't help that a guy who gives $288 million towards various causes, House races, Senate races, leaves your camp. But Elon Musk and Trump have been extremely tight. Now, Musk has been controversial. You know that. Every Democrat hates him. They're trying to blow up his cars, and I despise that. But when it came to the Doge, his idea, his suggestion during an interview he did on X with Trump, he said, listen, I'd love to do government efficiency. He got his team out there. He had a screaming match with Sean Duffy, transportation secretary. Went at it with Marco Rubio when it came to USAID. And then had a blistering fight with Scott Bessent, who basically yelled at him, you were supposed to save $2 trillion. It's $150 billion. What's going on here? And they since patched up. Well, with Trump, when he left and didn't get his NASA pick and then blew up the bill and then blew up Trump, Trump came back and then he hits him with, oh, he's on the Epstein list. And then a little bit later, they de-escalate. I've never seen anything like it from adults. And I can't really blame Trump. He was very calm. Judging by the social media postings, Musk wasn't. But the biggest story of consequence, and for my view, and I'm keeping my eye on this, got a bunch of balls in the air when it comes to Israel and Gaza, when it comes to Israel and Israel and Iran, when it comes to our nuclear talks with Israel, with Iran, which I have no patience for. I don't think they're going anywhere. And then when you have a political process taking all 12 weeks of President Trump's time and trying to get Ukraine and Russia to the table. I think Russia are the bad actors here. For some reason, a lot of Republicans are confused by this. I'm not. Andrew Weiss joins us now, Vice President of Studies at Carnegie for International Peace, served as a Russian expert in the Republican and Democratic administrations, including at the White House. Andrew, welcome.
Great to be here.
So I want you to hear what Donald Trump said yesterday after those, and I want to get your take on those incredibly innovative, resourceful attacks on Russia, inside Russia. Here's what Trump said. Cut 43.
Sometimes, and this is me speaking, maybe in a negative sense, but sometimes you see two young children fighting like crazy. They hate each other and they're fighting in a park. And you try and pull them apart. They don't want to be pulled. Sometimes you're better off letting them fight for a while and then pulling them apart. And I gave that analogy to Putin yesterday. I said, President, maybe you're going to have to keep fighting and suffering a lot because both sides are suffering before you pull them apart, before they're able to be pulled apart.
Your thoughts about what President Trump's interpretation on what's next?
I think the president's correct that we have a long-term problem on our hands. This war is not going to end on an accelerated timetable. When the president came into office, obviously he was shooting to do a big diplomatic deal with the Russians and the Ukrainians in short order. And the kind of problem that he has on his hands is not lending itself to easy solutions. The administration set a timeline, 100 days, I think, was the realistic one. The president himself seems very reluctant to call time or to assign blame for why this diplomatic process didn't bear fruit. But there's really no pressure on the Russians. And the United States has a tremendous amount of leverage on the Ukrainians. We've seen the United States try to use that. But even there, the United States is not in a position to simply ram a deal down Ukraine's throats. Putin thinks he's winning. He doesn't want a timeout. He thinks he can continue to grind the Ukrainians down. And when he looks at the strategic landscape, he sees the U.S.-Ukraine relationship is in tatters. U.S. relations.
But do you think that's accurate to say it's in tatters? Do you think, I mean, it's been strained up and down, but I wouldn't say it's in tatters. You really think it is?
I think it's in tatters in the sense that the confidence that the Ukrainians have that the United States is going to stick with them has gone away. And I think you heard yesterday the president's special envoy, General Kellogg, say in an interview that he thinks that the supply of weapons and intelligence cooperation will continue even if the administration, quote, walks away, which is something they've been threatening to do in the past month or two. So there is, I think, a realization inside the administration that totally cutting off Ukraine would not be in U.S. interest, that it's not in the U.S. interest to see Putin prevail in Ukraine. It's not in the U.S. interest to see, you know, something that looks a lot like the fall of Kabul happen on their watch. So they're stuck. I don't think the administration has great options here. But the real challenge in any process like this is how to build leverage. How do you force the Russians to do something they don't want to do?
Well, what you do is see 117 drones launched within their country, within their borders. When you see trains derailed, bridges blow up, and planes destroyed, that and they can't figure out how it happened. Those are the type of things that I maybe think the Russians might want to recalculate. I hear it's paralyzed their country. They're looking at every truck and every driver as a possible Ukrainian.
Yeah, no, you put your finger on it, Brian. That, you know, they've stirred up a hornet's nest here. Ukraine was a largely benign neighboring country, and now by virtue of launching this unprovoked invasion, Russia has its own worst nightmare on its hands. It has a Ukraine that's going to be armed to the teeth and armed with, you know, this intense sense of vendetta and need for revenge, and he's reinvigorated the NATO alliance. So these are all, you know, total blunders on this, you know, on an unthinkable scale for the Russians. The problem is Ukraine doesn't have the manpower, it doesn't have the sort of endless resources that Russia does in by comparison. So if the Russians' goal here is simply keep the war going and exhaust the Ukrainians and sort of show that the West is being outmatched in terms of how quickly we get our defense industry back online, that's their theory of victory. And, you know, the United States needs to be doing things that show Putin that he's wrong about that.
And do you think right now they need Patriots, they need artillery? Are we capable of giving it to them?
That is a key question. So just to walk you through this, you know, Ukraine has benefited from these very advanced air defense systems like the Patriots that the United States and other European countries are giving them. But there's a finite number of the interceptors, the rockets that are launched out of these anti-missile batteries. And the United States just doesn't make them at scale anymore. This is a system that, you know, is sort of, in, you know, in military terms, yesterday's news. And so our production lines are not churning this stuff out. And the Russians believe that if they just keep the war going, they can tap out Ukraine's available supply. That's the sort of fundamental wedge that the Russians are using, in that, you know, they believe they can restore dominance in Ukraine's skies and that the Ukrainians would then be forced to cut a deal with them. The West is scrambling to try to prove them wrong.
What I don't understand, and we're talking to Andrew Weiss, who's a Russian expert, what I don't get, Andrew, is, you know, this war's been going on for 3 years now, right? And we know the Israelis have been under attack since, you know, for 3 years. We've had plenty of time to ramp up. Why are we not ramped up yet? We have now a bunch of customers called NATO who want to get their defense spending up to 5%. They want to buy from us. This is a for-profit operation.
Totally agree. And I think the previous administration was in a complicated spot. On the one hand, everyone saw that the United States didn't produce things like the Patriot missile interceptors we were just talking about. It didn't produce very basic forms of artillery that were, you know, at this point in the U.S., you know, part of like mom and pop operations or very small scale industrial, you know, Eisenhower era production. So the problem for the previous administration was that the way they funded the war was in like 6 month, 8 month, or 3 month increments. There was no ability in Congress to force through big change like the Defense Production Act on the scale that Ukraine needed. So we were not ready to fight World War I, World War II, the Korean War all over again. We were planning on a different kind of war. And the politics of the U.S., I don't need to tell you this, are poisonous for some of these things. You know, the idea of big boosts in defense spending, big, you know, possible benefits for the large U.S. defense contractors, all of that are, you know, politically very divisive issues.
So I want you to hear what Germany was said yesterday, what their new chancellor said. I love his attitude, by the way, seemingly. Cut 45.
In the meantime, it's extremely complicated to bring the Russians to the table. That's the reason why I asked the president to do more on Russia and to put pressure on Russia. You know that there is a bill in the Senate drafted on more sanctions. I just had a debate, discussion with some colleagues from the Senate. So I very much hope that we will go along and that we will do the same. And the same has one goal, bring this terrible war to an end.
Right. And we become the natural gas supplier, which is another win for us. The pipelines are destroyed, linking them to an addiction to natural gas that they had with Nord Stream 1 and Nord Stream 2. So now we have two more formidable countries into NATO, which is impressive. And now we have just about all of them spending 2% and now going up to 5%. There's a lot of positives here. Now we got to do is take that $300 billion that we froze for Russia and then give it to the Ukrainians. Let them pay for this stuff. They'd be more than happy to do it and make the Russians understand that if you wait any longer, that $300 billion is gone. And give them a month or 2 weeks.
100%. You know, that's a great game plan. I wish it were something that could be put in practice. Instead, we have, you know, divisions that this administration is creating with the Europeans by threatening to pull out U.S. troops from Europe. So that's created a panic and a kind of bad dynamic with the Europeans because, you know, the Germans, you know, taking the most obvious example, are simply not in a position to replace the United States and provide the kind of security support that Ukraine desperately needs, let alone deter Russia from having designs on Europe in the future. The other problem the administration is creating is a sense from the Ukrainians that you're on your own and that, you know, there's an equivalence between what Ukraine is suffering and what Russia is suffering. And you heard a bit of that yesterday in what the president said in the Oval Office, where he sort of compared this to a, you know, hockey match or two kids fighting it out in a park. You know, the reality here is that Russia has launched an invasion, unprovoked invasion of a neighbor, and then, you know, committed atrocities and, you know, war crimes on a massive scale. Ukraine's defending itself. I think the U.S., you know, has an obligation, given our history, given our values, to support the victim in this case. And the administration has instead, and, you know, the president's candidate has sort of portrayed this as a political issue and has used it as a, you know, a thing to sort of beat Joe Biden up and to sort of say that, you know, there's two sides to every story. I think that's just fundamentally not the case.
I hear you. So inside Russia right now, some people have said he does not know how to stop the war, not just Trump. Other people have said that. It's like, how does he get his economy different, flowing in a different way than militarily? I hear 45% of his GDP is weapons making.
That's not bad for Vladimir Putin, right? I mean, Vladimir Putin has the ability to recruit more than 30,000 people a month. They're paying them top dollar. So, you know, the Russian available pool of manpower to fight in this war, even if they're being thrown into a meat grinder, is at the moment seemingly endless. There's lots of, you know, economically dispossessed parts of Russia that now get contracts to churn out these, you know, very rudimentary basic things, whether it's, you know, boots and uniforms or artillery shells and bombs that, you know, and bullets for the war effort. Or Russia gets stuff from China, Iran, and North Korea. So, you know, there is not a kind of pincer right now that Vladimir Putin is feeling that's going to change his calculus. And that's, again, that's what the administration has to focus on. It's like, how do you put pressure on this guy and get him off the path he's on? Nothing the administration is doing is shifting Putin's calculus. If anything, it's feeding his confidence.
It's amazing because, Andrew, after those attacks over the weekend and the blowing up the bridge for the third time that destabilized at the very least, and now you have a million casualties, dead or wounded, off the battlefield. This is the biggest disaster ever. He bolstered NATO, made them more militant, and he lost Syria because he took his eye off the ball there, and Iran lost an outlet, and they lost a port, eventually about to lose a port, certainly an ally. So if you look at this, is a disaster.
Oh, yeah. No, on all levels, it's a disaster. The question is it bad enough that something is going to, you know, come unstuck? Like, he's not running for re-election. Russia's not a democracy. The average age of that group of people who've been killed or wounded on the battlefield is in their mid-30s. These are not people's kids who just finished high school. These are grown men who volunteered for the very healthy payouts. So, you know, this is it's an ugly situation.
Got
where
it. It's important.
Russians are not, they're not running out of Russians, unfortunately, who are willing to go into the meat grinder.
Andrew, always like your perspective. Thanks so much. We'll see what happens next. I just hope Trump goes, yep, Senate sanctions are in. Nothing I could do, Vladimir. Goodbye. That would be great. I appreciate it. Andrew Weiss.
From your lips to God's ears, Brian. Thanks so much.
Back in a moment.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, this is Joe from Vanta. In today's digital world, compliance regulations are changing constantly, and earning customer trust has never mattered more. Vanta helps companies get compliant fast and stay secure with the most advanced AI, automation, and continuous monitoring out there. So whether you're a startup going for your first SOC 2 or ISO 27001 or a growing enterprise managing vendor risk, Vanta makes it quick, easy, and scalable. And I'm not just saying that because I work here. Get started at vanta.com.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
People leave my administration and they love us. And then at some point they miss it so badly. And some of them embrace it and some of them actually become hostile. I don't know what it is. It's sort of Trump derangement syndrome, I guess they call it. But we have it with others too. They leave and they wake up in the morning. And the glamour's gone. The whole world is different. And they become hostile. I don't know what it is.
Well, to tell you the truth, I have heard that from people that have left the Trump White House because they feel the stress, especially when they had the fake investigation. They really were fake investigations. And they get out and they say, wow, I miss it. I miss the pace. I miss the consequence. But I don't know what Elon Musk, I can't get inside his head. I know he's a genius, but he has no idea the political process. He's incapable of understanding compromise. And I had this brilliant analogy that almost everybody's just saying that it's brilliant. So I just have to go along with the crowd. And it's this. Imagine if you're in a classical band, like a symphony. And then the bassoon player doesn't get along with the oboe player. The clarinet player doesn't get along with the trumpet player. But your goal as the conductor is just to get that song out. Trump's goal is to get the song out. Musk is saying, I'm the trumpet player and my way is right. I don't care what everybody else thinks. We just have to do it my way. And I'm a genius. Well, the question is, that's not a matter. That's called a solo. You don't have a solo. You have a band. You have a symphony. And your goal is to make music.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
You've talked about that. I've talked about that. Republicans should do more. We should be more aggressive. Elon is correct that we need to be doing more to meet the moment. But unfortunately, the way this is spilled out is ignoring a lot of the good work we've done. We do need to take the good things, add to them, get rid of some of the bad things. I hope the Senate will do that. And to answer your question, spent a lot of time with some good friends in the Senate last night, good friends like Mike Lee and Rick Scott and others. And, you know, they're saying a lot of the right things. I think that the majority leader understands the need that we need to make the bill better.
So a couple of things. They do want to make the bill better, but the personal attacks against each other is so ridiculous. I mean, I can see if it's like 2 years later, they come back in retrospect. You're talking about hours. 1 minute, best friend, in January, says I love him as much as any heterosexual can love another man. And now all of a sudden he's on Jeffrey Epstein's list. I give you $288 million and you're not being grateful. Senator Mark Wayne Mullen is through it all. He knows Elon, knows President Trump, doing the fighting with the big, beautiful bill. And that's where things started to fracture, it seems, Senator. He did not like what was in this bill. I don't think, as smart as he is, he has any understanding of how Washington works or the way politics works.
Well, I mean, listen, I came right out of the business world into politics, and I couldn't figure it out in 130 days. And that's how long he had in the government, really 130 days. And so I understand his frustration. As a business owner, believe me, I understand his frustration. I tell everybody the biggest lesson I had to learn when I got into politics and coming out of the business world is how to take a deep breath, because I'm not simply dealing with a board that honestly, the board that I control, that I hire, I'm dealing with 400 at this time in the House. I was dealing with 435 other CEOs of districts with roughly the same amount of people in it than my district had. And there's a lot of personalities to navigate, and things don't move the way you want them to. And so I understand his frustration, but you also, I have to understand Elon too. I don't know if you've had the privilege of reading his book, but turmoil is where he works in. I mean, ex-executives and current executives and ex-friends have all said that, you know, he's toxic. He has a tendency to ruin relationships, and he admits to that too. But at the same time, those relationships can quickly be healed, and he can move right past it the next day. And I imagine something like that will probably happen. I thought Trump handled it very well on his last social media post where he said, you know, I wish Elon would have done this months ago. But the fact is, I inherited a mess, and I'm trying to clean it up and just move past it. And I think that showed leadership from President Trump.
So I want you to hear what he said could be the reason. Cut seven.
He wanted, and rightfully, you know, he recommended somebody from that he, I guess, knew very well. I'm sure he respected him, but to run NASA, and I didn't think it was appropriate. And he happened to be a Democrat, like totally Democrat. And I say, you know, look, we won. We get certain privileges, and one of the privileges, we don't have to appoint a Democrat.
So, and that was the beginning of it. Do you think there's something to that?
No, that's 100% accurate. Jared, the gentleman that was going to be the deputy assistant or deputy director of NASA, great guy. I had the privilege of sitting down and talking to him. But the fact is, he hadn't given to a single Republican other than President Trump when he looked like he was going to win when Elon got involved in it. But he hadn't given to any Republican. He actually gave a lot of money to Tester against Tim Sheehy, which Tim Sheehy was okay with that too, by the way. But that is accurate. It was Elon's guy. And I didn't know the president came out with this, Brian, so I wasn't going to come out with a story. I was just going to let it lay. But now that the president's bringing this up, it is true. Elon got a little upset, not a little upset, I would say really upset, that when they decided to move Jared out, Elon, he was upset about the timing because he's like, why did you guys wait until after I left before you do this? We had Jared teed up to the deputy director for NASA, the one that the president is referring to. We had him teed up to actually be confirmed on Monday, this week on Monday. And there was a lot of concerns, even through his hearing process, that he had not – he was definitely a Democrat, had definitely leaned those that direction, even through the last campaign cycle. There was but we were willing to look past that. And then there was some the issue came up that it wasn't actually accurate on some of the information he had given. He had told that he had given to Mark Kelly's PAC, which was and that's how his money got divided up to all the other ones. He gave a significant because that, you know, Mark Kelly was a former astronaut, and they had a friendship prior to politics. And so he had said that that's where all the money had got given out. But when people really started digging into it, that's not accurate, because if you give it to a PAC, then the PAC gives the money out. To have money directly given to you into Tester's account or to Schumer's account, that has to come from your organization personally. That doesn't come from Mark Kelly's PAC. It doesn't show up that way. And so that when that came to light, it really started falling apart for Jared, and that actually happened prior to Elon leaving. But the decision to actually remove him came over the weekend, and I support the president in this. You know, the president has made a very, very good picks on putting the right people in place. I mean, we see the agencies changing. We see the economy coming back. We see inflation dropping. Job reports are higher than expected. You know, countries are renegotiating.
The market's up 500 points.
So that's what I'm saying. So the president has, Brian, the president, I trust what the president is doing here.
Yeah.
So when the president makes a play call, I support it. And this was the right move. And we all need to realize that he's putting the right people in place to move the country in the direction it needs to go. But that is right. The president is accurate. Elon got very, very upset by it, and he went nuclear.
Senator Mark Mahon with us. And I know, Senator, I don't want to be callous to the fact that you guys could be slammed by tornadoes, correct? Is there a tornado warning in Oklahoma?
Well, that's called spring for us.
Okay.
I'm not trying to be callous to the idea either, but yes, absolutely. Right. My wife called me a while ago. It's horrible this time of the year. There's always damage. We try to, you know, we don't always lose lives every year because of tornadoes, but we always know that's a risk. But we're well prepared for it, and we call it the Oklahoma Standard. God forbid it does hit a populated area. We will respond in a fast manner and not just wait on FEMA to get there. Oklahomans respond.
Yeah, I usually go on KRMG in the morning, and they said not today because of tornadoes. But I want to talk about the bill that's in your lap. Like I like that Ron Johnson's approach. I want it better. I want more cuts, and we got to okay. But he wants to roll up his sleeves and do things. You know, I like. Look at Tillis has to worry about himself. Susan Collins. So go get busy. Go and negotiate. Go to work. I don't have any patience for Tom Massey and Rand Paul, who just want to sit on the sideline and say it's not good enough. So there's got to be an attitude. I want to make it better. This is my point of view. And then go and just get involved, right?
Yeah, well, you're absolutely correct. Ron John's smart. His approach sometimes is hard to take, but you have to realize that's his personality, and I always laugh about it. The other day, he was out on some show, and he called senators a bunch of old farts. And I walked up to him, and I said, hey, do we need to take a picture of who the old fart is here? And he started laughing, and he says, I didn't mean that to you. I said, I know, Ron. We were just, just joking. But he's extremely intelligent. He does want to make it better, and you're right. He is desperately involved in this. You take somebody like Rand Paul, who is just, I only support it if you take out the debt limit increase. But that means that we're going to have to negotiate with the Democrats later to do the debt limit increase because we know we're going to have to raise the debt. And because, as the president said, we inherited this mess. We can't just simply get out of it. They spent like drunken sailors before President Trump got there. We're going to have to borrow some more money to get us to the point where we need to go. And if we don't do it through reconciliation, that means we're going to have to negotiate to get 60 votes. And that we'll have to give the keys to the White House away to do that because Schumer is not going to give us the votes for it. And then Rand Paul probably wouldn't even vote for the debt limit increase in him because he never has. So you go back to Ron Johnson. We call him Ron John, but it's Ron Johnson.
I'm with you.
From Wisconsin. And Ron is really trying hard. He's trying to lean in on it. Here's the thing that you have to realize, though. You can have the greatest idea in the world, but it means nothing if you can't get 51 people to vote for it.
I hear you.
So this is what negotiating, not compromise. This is what negotiating is about, and this is why we go from perfect bills to good bills. And there's a lot of people on our side that is like, hey, you're Republicans negotiating with Republicans. Why can't it be perfect? Well, because we're Republicans from Oklahoma and Republicans. There's not any Republicans, I guess, in the House.
Sure. Yes.
You got Mike Lauer from New York. So we have to negotiate with him because it doesn't matter if we get 51 in the House if we can't get whatever the number is. I can't say just 218 in the House because we got to get 51 in the Senate, 218 in the House. But they only get past the last one with 215. So it depends on who falls asleep and who walks
shows
away,
up,
right? Yeah, and so we have to – both of them have to get across the finish line. So we got to negotiate. People are talking about eliminating salt. And it's appetizing. It's an appetite, right? Because salt is $350 billion. We could eliminate salt altogether because we – in the Senate, we don't have a dog in the fight. We don't have any senators from blue states. So we could eliminate that and take the deficit spending from 1.6 over 1.6. The House is calling, or the Senate's call, or the White House calls it 1.7, but let's just not overstate it and say 1.6 to nearly $2 trillion of deficit cuts. However, we could do that, but it will never pass the House because of that. So we can't do that. We got to negotiate at that point. They're at 40,000 for salt for deductions. Maybe we could take it down to 35. Maybe we could take it down to 30, but I don't think we could possibly get past 30. I was talking to Mike Lauer last night, and he's up in arms. He's like, man, there's five of us that we might as well not even run again if you do this to us because it'll absolutely kill us in our states.
Well, yeah, so
that's what we're dealing with.
So Medicare, this is what I hear today. Senate Republicans are now eyeing possible Medicare provisions to help offset the cost of the bill to appease budget hawks who want more spending cuts and better than legislation. Now, famously, President Trump says, I'm not touching Medicare and I'm not touching Medicaid. Are you guys revisiting Medicare? I mean, at some point you have to. I just don't know if this is the point. Your thoughts?
Well, so, Brian, this is where we get into where Elon has done a phenomenal job bringing in DOGE. DOGE is going to be part of our government now. We're not going to get rid of it. Even when the Democrats come and get in charge one of these days, because, it goes back and forth. But even if they do get in charge one of these days, they're going to keep DOGE. They're just going to have a different name for it. Because we have a responsibility to identify waste and fraud. And what Elon had brought is he brought a program that helps identify that much faster than the government was able to do it before he arrived. And so we are not going to change any benefits to any eligible recipients. And I need to be clear about that. No benefits will be changed to any eligible recipient, regardless if it's in Medicare or Medicaid. What we are looking at is waste and fraud, meaning which people should not be up there. Every year we get billions of dollars that are sent to us from these programs that identify missed payments, meaning that they should have never went out to begin with. And we're in Elon, I'm just saying that this is where he did some well, did a good job, is that he's like, well, if we can show that it was a missed payment, then why is it that we can't identify it and get it off the books? And we're like, yeah, that makes sense. Why shouldn't we be able to do that? It's the way we do it in business. And so if we're looking at Medicare, it's looking at just the fraud and the wasteful spending. That is it. No benefit changes. The president has been very clear about that. Republicans have been very clear about that. But there is no reason why we can't get into the waste and fraud. And the Democrats want to lie about this. Even CNBC right now can't even justify Schumer's lies. I was on a program there, and I brought that up, and I said, it's a lie, and you guys know it's a lie. And they said, yes, we're not even debating that at this point. And so, that was on CNBC.
So Senator Mullen is with us now. Senator, do you realize the Democrats are so out of it in that you guys are negotiating with yourselves on spending cuts? They don't want any spending cuts.
None.
So zero.
None.
So they can't even get involved in the debate. They could just say it's a bad bill. But why? When it comes to the why, and they're totally on a different page than Musk and Mullen and Trump. However, when it comes to Musk in particular, Democrats can't be rooting for this because they've already vilified Musk as worse than Trump. So how could they pretend as if now Musk is their guy? So they don't even have any idea what to do.
They don't. They don't have a leg to stand on. Here's where the Democrat Party is, anti-Trump. No matter what Trump is for, they're against. For instance, the tax extensions. You know, they're out there saying that we're going to give tax breaks to the billionaires and the millionaires if this and pay it on the backs of low income. And all we're doing is extending the current tax policy. So you have two choices in this year. We have two choices. We either extend and make the tax cuts permanent that President Trump put in place in 2018, which spurred the economy, which the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, said was going to cost the government $1.5 trillion, and actually in literally a year and a half had a $1.6 trillion surplus. Almost a $3 trillion swing from what they had agreed to, and so what we're saying is those same tax policies, let's not let them expire, because if it expires, it doesn't just affect the millionaires and billionaires, it affects every single individual, and it will affect every single individual in the tunes of thousands of dollars, and so. But yet they would rather, not only do they want to spend more,
right,
but they want us to send more money to Washington, D.C. by letting the current tax policy expire.
He is Senator Mark Wayne Mullen. He's got his plate full and a civil war to settle and a bill to pass. Besides that, not much going on. Senator Mark Wayne Mullen, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on, Brian.
Back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
All I can say is whenever I was around him, his mind was clear, his judgment was good, and he was on top of his brief.
That's right.
But look at that debate, for example. Mm-hmm. What happened in the 10 days before his debate, and what were the White House staff thinking? He went to Europe and back twice, and then he went to California once.
Yeah.
And he was 80 years old. What the heck is he doing that for?
And sick.
Why was that allowed to happen? So there's a lot of questions I don't know. All I know is I think we should think less about that and more about the future.
Right. I'm sure you won't. Bill Clinton going to bat for his colleague, Joe Biden. Well, let's just look at that. Let's just look at that statement. You know why he went back and forth? Because George Clooney had a fundraiser. So who told him to go to the G7? Well, that should do when you're president. The G20, that should do when you're president. Who told him also to go back and forth for his trial? That's what he was doing. And he had a cold. If you can't perform as president with a cold, you shouldn't be president. And if you can't fly back and forth to Europe two times, you shouldn't be president. And if you're that wiped out, you shouldn't be president. And everybody knows, according to reports, they knew he could not take the 2 o'clock call. That's he should not have been president. And Bill Clinton should know that. On top of that, to have this week come out that KJP is coming out with a book that says Broken White House, why she's an independent. Broken White House. He told us everything was great, that he's going 100 miles an hour. You can't keep up with him. Everyone knows that a press secretary be spinning, but flat out lying? Lying? I mean, this is as bad as Woodrow Wilson's wife saying he had a stroke, not denying he had a stroke and actually running the country. Now, you wouldn't believe the hate going KJP's way. Why? Because she's a total DEI hire. They wanted somebody that was going to check the boxes. And I'm harkening back to what Joe Manchin said to me. He went up to Joe Biden and looked at his staff and said, you got a bunch of left-wingers here. This isn't you. He said, but look at how diverse they are. He said, so what? They're bad. I mean, this is not you. So he gets a black lesbian who checked the boxes. It was impossible to fire. Not for Trump. He'd fire in a second. Because he's not under that auspices. He's into a meritocracy. Why is Kamala Harris the vice president? Because she's a woman of color and she's a woman. That's why you had a bad vice president. Why is Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg got a job? Because he can speak and he's gay.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you've been with us all week long, and what a week it's been, right? Carly Shimkus is going to join us at the bottom of the hour, the outstanding anchor from Fox and Friends First, and then Shannon Bream is standing by. She is doing a great job filling in special report as well as doing her own thing, and she was just in Boston over the weekend. So we have a lot to discuss today, a lot of moving parts to go over. We know this. Multiple reports do not expect Trump to call Musk today. I don't think ever it's going to be up to Elon to do it, which brings me to the big three.
Number three.
I think what bothers me about this is it seems like she was in the White House for her own personal gain, that she had had a publicist working for her pro bono to lift up her profile. When you're in government service, you're not supposed to worry about your own personal profile.
Yes, and she was. That's a former Biden DOJ official. Joe Biden's world absorbs another body blow, even though it's from a lightweight KJP. Why I think it still keeps Dems off their game and allows the GOP to do some open field running.
Number two.
It creates economic growth, which if the Congressional Budget Office wasn't a bastion of idiotic left-wing thinking, by itself, the economic growth would virtually pay for the bill. You know, Musk probably ought to get a briefing on the real bill rather than his personality feelings.
The big, beautiful bill moves ahead. Why I believe the turbulence with Musk will actually make the overall package better.
Number one.
But I'm very disappointed because Elon knew the inner workings of this bill better than almost anybody sitting here, better than you people. He knew everything about it. He had no problem with it. All of a sudden, he had a problem.
That is President Trump. Must Trump go from meltdown to truce? But now, how much damage has been done personally and politically, and who will pay the price? The last thing that I could see that Musk posted, Shannon Bream, was when he said, you know, vote. Do you want to see a third party? And that's Musk thinks he could spin off a third party. He knows he's never going to go with the Democrats, especially after things he said. And we now know he believes. But people said that these two will gradually get sick of each other. But I didn't predict this. Did you?
Well, you got to think when they both have huge soapboxes, a ton of money, and giant egos that at some point there was going to be a break. And it came over. Listen, Elon says, I come to D.C. at great professional and personal cost to me, get all into the weeds with, you know, getting rid of government spending, waste, fraud, abuse, all this stuff. And then I see Washington do what it always does, which is put together a bill that spends a whole lot more money. And I think for him, that was just the breaking point. But President Trump's not going to back down on that. His entire agenda is wrapped up in this big, beautiful bill. And the two just could not coexist in the way that they saw this thing.
Do you believe some people have speculated this is a showdown between the tech right, you know, conservatives who are in Silicon Valley, and the MAGA populists? Is this bigger than that? Is it, is it bigger than these two men? Is it more like these two ideologies clashing?
I mean, I think in a lot of ways you could argue that it is, because you see people lining up with the two different ones here. And here's the thing. We've got Senator Rick Scott on this weekend, and he's one of those guys in the Senate who's been sort of leaning no, it seems like, leading up to this vote on the big, beautiful bill. He's been very much in lockstep with what Elon's been saying about we're spending way too much money. We are selling our kids' futures, our grandkids' futures. It's the same language you've heard from Ron Johnson and some of the others over there, too. So it may be... Yeah, this clash of ideologies of where do you go? Because, listen, tech was so skeptical and anti-Trump for years and years and years until the last year or so, where you saw those heavy hitters like Elon come over and say, like, okay, maybe we can do better things for this country. But, again, he did that at great personal and professional cost, and he's probably now – as we saw yesterday when this thing went 0 to 100 very quickly, wants to burn the place down on the way out. He got the key to the White House a week ago.
16% drop with Tesla stock, and now you have the country up, the S&P up 500 points. So the stock market, the Dow is up 500 points on the jobs numbers, 133,000. So they're not worried. They're not sweating this. Now, how do you feel about the story that Senate Republicans are eyeing possible Medicare provisions to help offset the cost of the big bill, which should appease budget hawks? What could they be looking at in Medicare, which we all know needs to be reformed?
Right. Well, you know, they've had this ongoing conversation about work requirements for able-bodied people. I think some of that, they feel like there's more room in there to get people kicked off these roles who are not the intended people, who are vulnerable and desperate and need this help. There's also talk of, you know, asking the Democrats to actually pledge and commit to a vote that anyone who is in this country illegally and found to be on the rolls should be kicked off. It's interesting that some of them confronted in the halls of Congress won't even commit to that. So there are folks in the Senate who think that there's more room to shave this down. But then you've got folks like Josh Hawley who are very worried that people who legitimately need these programs are going to get cut off. It's not only, you know, bad policy and bad for human beings, but it's a really bad optic for Republicans,
too. So what you just explained, we're going over every day. We do this every day. Why can't Elon Musk not pick this up? Why doesn't he understand that Lawler's not a bad person, but he's got a different view of Chip Roy because they represent different people? He just can't get his head around it. Well, just do the right thing. Well, you can do the right thing. That's called being a king. But in our situation, that's doing what you want. You got to do what's possible. He doesn't seem to understand that, as bright as he is.
And it's really difficult. You know, to get anything across the finish line here in Washington requires enormous compromise. Nobody is getting everything they want. Nobody is getting a balanced budget every time. Nobody is getting all of this stuff cut, all of the pork and all the junk. I mean, they're all guilty of it. But look at what the speaker had to cobble together. It's basically held together with like paper clips and bubble gum to get this thing across and out of the House. And now they have to worry that the fighting in the Senate is going to leave them in a place where something comes back. They cannot survive all of those coalitions and side deals being put together so you get this thing done. If it was as easy as everybody on the outside wants to think it is, we wouldn't have these problems we have with deficit and debt and all of those things. There are no easy solutions. And when you have to get somebody like Chip Roy on board, you're going to have to make some negotiations. But even he has said, no, this bill is not great. I'm not in love with it, but it's the best thing that we could come up with.
So I got to bring it over to Joe Biden. And, you know, we thought we had a bigger story with the book being written of Original Sin about what he was vacuous as he was there, barely able to function as a president. But now the biggest surprise for me, KJP put out a book soon to be released called Independent, The Story Inside a Broken White House. Excuse me? Broken White House? The anger that's directed at her is off the charts, and it's all coming from the left about our intellect, laziness, knowing the issues, having a publicist, personal gain, not going for the White House. I'm watching this slow motion car wreck. I thought I saw the only one. but I am seeing a arguably bigger one.
I'm super confused. And I don't know if you are, too, as somebody who has been a bestseller of books. What is the strategy here?
I don't know.
Republicans already did not like her, okay?
Yep.
So Democrats are now pissed. Excuse my French, but they are not happy about this. The book's called Independent. Who is going to buy this thing? It seems like the worst marketing plan ever. Offend everybody. And now the people who were defending you for the past couple of years have turned on you, and very publicly, some of them. So I'm not sure what the plan is here. And you put in the title, like you said, the broken White House. You were running the messaging for this thing. You were telling people as a 40-something distance runner, you couldn't keep up with the president. I mean, it's so laughable at this point. She's alienating every possible constituency or book buyer she would have.
Yeah, I mean, I'm curious to see what exactly she's going to reveal. I know she doesn't like Admiral Kirby. Here's the DOJ spokesperson, whose name is unpronounceable to a civilian like me, but on CNN, listen to this, cut 31.
I think what bothers me about this is the fact that it seems like she was in the White House for her own personal gain and not to service the American people.
I agree
and
with
to
you.
And part of that is Alex Thompson has some reporting that she had a publicist working for her pro bono to lift up her profile. When you're in government service, you're not getting paid a lot. You're not supposed to worry about your own personal profile. You fight tooth and nail every single day to defend your boss, to tell the truth, and to make sure that you are doing everything to communicate with the American people.
Right. So how do you figure this? And then she does that, but it would bother me most. For example, and I'll just say for a Democrat, Jen Psaki did a really good job because she knew the policy.
Yeah.
She didn't see this woman, KJP, didn't know the policy. So I would look at this just for the questions, like to help me with the shows, because the answers were all empty. And it's not spin. They were just empty because she didn't understand it. And now she wants to write as if she's above it.
Right. And the tricky thing for her always has been is there was such a big deal made about the identity politics, that she was a black female, that she was openly gay. All of that stuff is put onto you, then people will begin to question if you were hired for your abilities or to make a statement, to make a good showing, you know, politically with the left. And I think for many, you know, there were many times I looked and thought, oh, is she so ready to leave this job? But I think those things kind of trapped her almost, that she had to stay there and show she was going to fight and she was the first of this, the first of that, that she was going to be up to the job and stay, when she had a lot of people internally who did not have confidence in her and her ability to protect the president and to articulate his policies in a way that made sense.
So these Democratic cowards who won't put their name on it say this to Axios. She was one of the most ineffectual, unprepared people I've ever worked with. She had meltdowns after any interview and asked what a topic not sent over by producers. She didn't know how to manage a team, didn't know how to shape and deliver a message, and often created more problems than she solved. The hubris of thinking you can position yourself as an outsider when you can not only have enjoyed the perks of extreme proximity to power, which bestows on the name recognition needed to sell books of your name, but have actively wielded it from the biggest pulpit there is, as breathtaking as it is desperate. It's difficult to see how this is anything but a bizarre cash grab. And finally, the amount of time that was spent coddling KJP and appeasing her was astronomical compared to our attention to actual matters of substance. Wow. Man, do these people were dying to empty their spleen on this woman.
Yeah, and the minute that she said, I'm leaving the party and there's got to be a better way and the White House is broken, she just opens the floodgates. It gives them the green light to do all of this, which, again, there's going to be nobody protecting her. She's got nobody out there. I can't imagine what this book tour is going to be like and what the interviews are going to be like. It's just so bizarre to me because there were people who felt like she was a drag on what they were trying to do. She's probably going to feel like, you know what, I stood up there and took slings and arrows and defended this president at a time that, you know, people with their own eyes could see what was going on, and I had to pretend like it was never happening. But does she own up to any of that in the book, her role in this whole thing and the cover-up, and something that, absent that June debate, would have probably led to President Biden running for a second full term, when we've got admissions in books like Original Sin from close aides who were like, we knew he wasn't up to it, we just needed to get him elected, and then he could hide for 4 years and somebody else would run the show.
But the revelations in the book Original Sin, which talks about running for re-election, which is crazy. He really dates back to 2020, that he was failing right after his son died in 2016. So that's why Obama probably never thought he should run, but he never would say it. Then once he got in there, tried to help him. But now everybody hates everybody, right? Pelosi and Biden don't talk to each other.
Right.
Obama, Pelosi, and Biden don't talk to each other. Carville just sits on the sideline and rants. Axelrod's mad he doesn't get invited to Obama's parties. KJP doesn't want to talk to anybody else in her party.
She's not invited to any parties.
Yeah, we're the only ones going to parties. Who's coming on your show tonight? On Sunday morning.
Our party on Sunday is going to have OMB Director Russ Vogt. He's got to convince these senators to get this thing across the finish line, the big, beautiful bill, in a way that will get it back to the House where it can pass. We've got Rick Scott, who sees things differently at the moment than Russ Vogt does with respect to the debt and deficit. We've also got Michael McCaul on with us, head of House Foreign Affairs, to talk about Russia, Iran, Israel, all of this stuff that's blowing up around the world. So we got a lot jam-packed in. And it sets us up for your show on Sunday night, which includes?
Oh, yeah, which includes a couple of people you'll like. Tim Scott, Senator Tim Scott. Ben Shapiro will be on with us, too. Then we're going to talk to, I think you're going to love this guest, Mitch Daniels, who was an OMB director, can talk about the bill, but he also was president of Purdue. And he had a big population of Chinese students. How does he feel about international students? How does he feel about these protests on campus? So I want to get his perspective on that. And then we're going to have Emily Austin on the media moments that matter. And we're going to have a special guest. And he is Neil Donahue. And he is one of the stars of a brand new PBR movie. It is like the Rocky of bull riding.
Yes.
And he is on Yellowstone. And he has always been traditionally a bad guy. And this one, he's a good guy.
Oh.
He also has this idea that he gave President Trump that the Trump administration loves. He goes, what about MAGA TV? He goes, nothing but patriotic movies. And evidently the White House heard him say that and is bringing him there and says, let's launch this thing.
Well, listen, the president knows business.
There you go.
TV. Maybe this is a perfect fit for him.
Right.
I mean, yeah, think about you just watching, you know, like Chuck Norris movies all day. I think that could fire you up.
Yeah, and then Rocky IV when he beats the Russian, although I don't want to give away the ending.
Dang it. I was going to rent that this weekend.
Yeah, don't do it.
I'm going to Blockbuster.
Right. Well, it's a little scary because Apollo does die, too.
What?
Yes. Scary.
Okay. I knew I should have rented it earlier.
So, Shannon, I can't wait for your show Sunday morning and my Sunday night.
It's going to be a 1-2 punch of information and entertainment, and this time you're going to dance, as promised.
Possibly. Go get him. Shannon Bream, thank
you. See you Sunday.
All right. Meanwhile, bottom of the hour, our Coley Shimkus will join us coming up next. And I see we got stops in Tulsa, Virginia, New Jersey. Don't move.
Want even more, Brian? Download the podcast at BrianKilmeadShow.com. Every episode, exclusive interviews on demand. More of Kilmeade coming up. Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Certainly we hope a deal is possible. I mean, President Trump has said Iran will not get nuclear weapons. President Trump has also said he's committed to a peace and negotiation process. Let's hope that's fruitful. Ultimately, that's not my department. My department is to be prepared should that not happen. And we're hopeful that peace happens, that they are willing to deconstruct their nuclear capabilities. But at the same time, from our view, we're prepared should the president call on us. But again, we're hoping Steve Witkoff and his team, we know how dedicated they are to peace, and we're hoping that's ultimately the outcome.
Secretary of Defense Hegseth saying, you know, he doesn't do policy, he executes plans. And essentially, I have no hope that Witkoff is going to get anything done except for a bad deal, because the Ayatollah said, I will not stop spinning centrifuges and enriching uranium. It's case closed, guys. Lee, you're in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hey, Lee.
Oh, Brian, I'm calling about two things. The fact that Trump's not cutting Medicare, I think that's a good idea because a lot of doctors are not making anything, especially on the HMOs. I took my dog to two vets, and my bill was over $400. I had a urinalysis test, and they got $1.86.
Got it. Understand. Sandra in New Jersey. Hey, Sandra.
Hello,
Hello, Brian. Brian, I have three things I wanted to say real quick. One, Jean-Pierre is a classic example of why DEI is a mistake. You know, that's an example of what goes wrong. Two, I was in Barnes & Noble yesterday, and I was very surprised to find a book that Chuck Schumer wrote, War Against Anti-Semitism. When did he ever do anything to help the Jewish people? I was so shocked. And then the last thing that I wanted to ask you, is it true that Lindsey Graham is getting sidekicks from Ukraine? And if that's true, that's terrible.
He's not. Absolutely not. He would never do that. Not in a million years. What he does is understands Ukraine are the good guys. And he wants to see the president hit him with sanctions. And I hope he does.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
But I'm very disappointed because Elon knew the inner workings of this bill better than almost anybody sitting here, better than you people. He knew everything about it. He had no problem with it. All of a sudden, he had a problem. And he only developed the problem when he found out that we're going to have to cut the EV mandate, because that's billions and billions of dollars. And it really is unfair. We want to have cars of all types. Electric, we want to have electric, but we want to have a gasoline, combustion. We want to have different. We want to have hybrids. We want to have all. We want to be able to sell everything.
So that is President Trump trying to figure out and explain what Elon Musk could have been doing in trying to leave the White House and then blow the place up as he left, saying the bill is going to add so much to the deficit and it goes against DOGE. And then I talked to Senator Mark Wayne Mullen, and he said it really has to do with the NASA guy. He had only given to Trump after he was clearly going to win. And he also gave a lot to Democrats prior, and he made a lot of people uncomfortable. I actually don't think it matters if NASA guy is a Democrat or Republican, but that ticked off Elon Musk, Senator Mullen said, and that led to this meltdown. Also, the EV mandate is gone. That's what the president speculated on. But then it got really personal. Carly Shimkus joins us now, co-host of Fox and Friends First. Carly.
Hey.
So what do you think derailed it?
You know, I was just listening to you give that explanation of the NASA guy, and then there's also been reporting that it could have been, you know, Starlink being used in various ways and the EV mandate. And these are all these are all relatively insignificant things when it comes to how closely they work together and potentially what they could have done in the future. Don't you think that he could have just called Trump and been like, hey, listen, I mean, this is my guy. I really would appreciate if he becomes the NASA administrator, talked about it like a civil person. I am shocked by this escalation. And quite frankly, I think that what happened yesterday makes Trump look like a sympathetic figure.
In what
because,
way?
Well, Elon Musk was just going nuts. I mean, talking about impeachment and working with J.D. Vance and calling for a third party. And Trump was just responding, and I think genuinely shocked at what was coming at him. So politically, I mean, I think that, you know, all of what Donald Trump's personality is baked in. He's not running again. But I think that if he wants to potentially win this news cycle in any way, I don't even know if it's really about winning a news cycle. I hate that phrase. I don't know why I just said it. But it just in terms of seizing the moment, I mean, just say, yeah, I still have no idea what happened there. This is about, we're going to press forward with the big, beautiful bill. That seems like a lot of noise. He's got a lot going on. I could have won on my own. I mean, that's not true. Donald Trump didn't need Elon Musk to win. Look at who the opponent was. It was Kamala Harris. Come on.
And plus, he was badly outspent by Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
He always is.
But I think just treat it like the noise that it is coming from Elon. And hopefully one day, I don't know if today would be the day for the phone call to happen. Apparently it's not going to. Maybe in a month from now. And then they could maybe talk it out after cooler heads have prevailed. But so far, I feel like Donald Trump has been, you know, relatively mild when it comes to the attacks that Elon Musk have been throwing at him.
So the last time Elon Musk posted was 43 minutes ago. And he says, congratulations to Tesla Berlin team. Evidently, they put out their 8 millionth vehicle. As you know, Tesla yesterday was down 18% because of this meltdown, because of it. He also said, hey, SpaceX, I'm going to just sideline my space capsule. Then he realized it's probably not a good move.
By somebody on Twitter who said, maybe you shouldn't do that. And he was like, okay.
Yeah.
I mean, like, let's workshop this in real time.
And the thing is, Amazon would step up. No one can beat SpaceX. I get it. No, and Starlink, I understand it. But people would step up in the interim, and plus you could take a lot of the technology that the government financed and use it towards other people in private finance. So nothing, 21 hours, 23 hours. I mean, this is a 17 hours. He retweeted something Jesse put on his show. So there's really not a lot going on between
right now,
them today.
Yeah, and thankfully.
So we'll see. We'll see where it stands. I thought John Fetterman nailed it yesterday, saying, really? Now Democrats are embracing Elon Musk? Cut 12.
Are Democrats disingenuous, suddenly finding Elon Musk as their new best friend?
Well, I'm saying, though, it's like he's right about the big, beautiful bill. And now suddenly it wasn't that long ago that Tesla's was like the virtue signaling kind of accessory for Dems as well, too. So now where we are on all this kind of a thing now, where I follow what is the truth. I would never want to vandalize Tesla's. And now the big, beautiful bill is wrong for America. And so from my perspective, it's like I just try to be consistent through that.
He is being consistent, but I totally agree with him on it being wrong for America. There's so much there more positive. And I just think there's very few people are reading the 1,000 pages.
Yeah, I know. And when it comes to the bill, it's so funny. How many clips have we gotten this week of Democrats from Chuck Schumer on down saying, I actually agree with Elon Musk. I can't believe I'm saying this, but I actually
do. For the wrong reason.
Very different reasons. I mean, they want to expand government spending and Elon Musk wants to cut it.
Right.
And also when it comes to the burning of the Teslas, listen, there are a lot of Republicans out there. I mean, I guess people, I don't know if people are choosing sides. Maybe they are a little bit, but I highly doubt we're going to see the burning of Teslas if Elon Musk and Donald Trump ever.
Run by Republicans.
Yeah, ever really
But by the way, Republicans go, you know, I didn't want an electric car anyway. I was doing it out of loyalty because of which the abuse he's taken. Now they'll walk away from it. Alicia Krauss is a conservative journalist. She said this to Trace Gallagher last night, Cut 22.
Musk has made a drastic shift to the right within the last 4 years. I think that this also serves as fair warning for conservatives of like, just because somebody says or does one thing that you like or they support your guy for a little while doesn't mean that at the core they are morally conservative. And maybe we need to take pause and consider that in the future.
Good point.
That's interesting. Although Elon Musk would disagree with that because he said on X, when he talked about forming the third party, he said, how about I form a third party of a moderate party that 80% of the country agree with? I don't know. Maybe he is still a moderate at his core. I don't know. Brian, how crazy is this?
It
just blew up out of nowhere.
Yeah, I didn't expect
it. And there were so many positive things going on, and there still are. And, you know, before this took place, everybody was talking about Joe Biden and Corinne Jean-Pierre's book and
Maybe we should do that, but I just want to let before we go. So what they did is they got the cameras. They tried to get as many lawmakers as possible. Here's Derek Van Orden, Wisconsin, Troy Nail of Texas, Nails, and Mike Johnson, the Speaker, Cut 17.
You were very concerned about tweets, but I think the American people are concerned about things that really matter.
Elon, I've had a lot of love and respect for you for what you've done for this country over the last several months. But you've lost your damn mind.
He's not a member of Congress. Listen, anybody who's going to be intimidated by somebody politically whose last name isn't Trump is barking up the wrong tree.
That is Derek Van Orden, Navy SEAL. He's 100% right.
He really is. And the start of this feud was over the bill. And Donald Trump even said, listen, I don't love everything in it. I mean, this is a massive bill. There's such a slim majority in the House. Politics is the art of compromise. It's not going to be perfect.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what we're working with. And it's certainly better to have the tax cuts and the border security and all of the good things in the bill than allowing those tax cuts to lapse. And then look what happened to the economy then.
So you look at KJP and she comes out with a book. The subtitle says Broken White House, Independent. She's leaving the party. The party hates her. And they all let it all hang out. Although they don't have the courage to put their name on it. But the stuff that they're saying about her now that she's come out and said the party basically isn't worthy of her is just crazy. I mean, here's an example of here we go. You know, why did I have these tabs and it didn't go? Here we go. You're going to be really impressed when I actually get this. So this is what they're saying about KJP. Says she's written a book about a broken White House, which she says she sees as a betrayal of the former president, many of her former colleagues, the face of the White House for more than 2 years was part of the problem. Then she says this, This is anonymous, of course. She was one of the most ineffectual, unprepared people I've ever worked with, according to somebody she worked with every day. She didn't know how to manage a team. She didn't know how to shape a delivery. She often created more problems than she solved. The hubris thinking you can position yourself as an outsider when you've enjoyed all the perks of being an insider.
Yikes.
And it goes on and on and on. So are people going to buy this book?
I mean, that's brutal. I guess a small portion. I don't know how much, what kind of, maybe for intrigue reasons, if you are political, maybe even on the right, just to see.
You have to,
just to see what. I don't know if the people on the left would even want to, because it just reminds them of what a train wreck things are right now. Right. I mean, I don't know what her calculus was in making this book and declaring this in this way after the disaster that is the Biden presidency. And I don't know what it is about Democrats writing books that are such indictments on their own, their careers. You have, you know, the Jake Tapper book that is basically like, I screwed up.
Yeah.
In covering this, that's
and
what the
even
book
worse
have been
than the Republicans said it was.
Yes, and now KJP doing this to herself.
Right. I mean, this is it's incredible, and the Republicans go, "Okay, I'll just keep working because I'm not negotiating with you on the big beautiful
yeah.
bill. We're not negotiating on foreign policy. So, what are we working on? I mean, after this bill is passed, which I think will, you know, I think they'll get a Senate version by July 4th, unless Elon Musk does something else unpredictable. And that it gets some traction. And then once this passes, I think that you're going to be looking at immigration reform, Social Security reform. I think you'd be looking at Medicare reform. And you could see who could play ball and who doesn't want
yeah,
to.
Exactly.
The entitlements will be front and center.
Yeah. And then there's still the foreign policy stuff that Trump is working on. Gaza, Israel, all of those things that are still going on. So there could be a lot of news made
right.
past this moment.
So just remember what KJP said about President Biden's acuity.
Does the president have the stamina, physically and mentally, do you think, to continue on even after 2024?
Don, you're asking me this question. Oh, my gosh. He's the president of the United States. You know, I can't even keep up with him.
How is President Biden ever going to convince the three quarters of voters who are worried about his physical and mental health that he is okay, even though in Las Vegas he told a story about recently talking to a French president who died in 1996.
I'm not even going to go down that rabbit hole with you,
what?
Sir.
What is
I mean, look, that was, as I said, it was a cheap, you know, a cheap fake. That was definitely a cheap fake. It was.
Here's what Alex Thompson said about the cheap fake line.
So when we were reporting the book, I remember talking to a fairly senior White House person, and they were like, they basically made it like, yes, he was bad. Yes, we shouldn't have run him again. Yes, like he was really struggling. But they sort of got in my face. They were like, you guys bought our like bought some of our spin. And they specifically mentioned the cheap fake stuff. They were like, this person was like, we could not, at least they were speaking for themselves. They were like, I could not believe we got those stories placed.
What? They were even surprised at their success. Why? Because the media was just lapping it up. Okay, they're going to give it to us, then we're going to print it. I mean, how many articles were there written where the headline was talking about how bad deep fakes have gotten, deep fake videos have gotten, and it's even plaguing the president? I come on. And we all saw it before our eyes. It was happening in real time.
I mean, I feel bad for Peter. And I don't feel bad, but Peter's head must be spinning because every question he asked, he was told it was illegitimate. We're right on the money.
I know.
And then everything that we discussed, we were told that's right-wing propaganda. Mm-hmm. It was 100% true. And now that they are making money off verifying what we said and that they ignored.
I know.
Without acknowledging that we had it right.
I know.
Jake Tapper at one point told Megyn Kelly conservative media had it right. I wouldn't say we're even conservative media. We're just media. And the other thing would be, it's like this. I do great at analogies, so I just want to warn you.
Okay, good.
It's like being caught cheating in a relationship and then saying, I can't believe you let me get away with it for so long. It's your fault. Right?
And I'm there.
Like,
how dare
you?
Yes,
you bought my dumb excuses.
This is
it's
really on you.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The mental gymnastics. It's so true. And then did you catch Karine Jean-Pierre when she was exasperated by, you know, is Joe Biden too old to run again? And then now we're learning from these anonymous sources. No one is saying who their name is. That she would be incensed when somebody asked her a question that a producer didn't tell her the topic in advance. I mean, she's the White House press secretary, which means that she needs to be. It's a very difficult job. But
that means
you need
also
to be well-versed on every topic. And just by the nature of your job, you are.
Right. But here's the thing. Do you realize that she's saying to you that I got a heads up on all my White House questions ahead of time?
Yeah, that's also
I mean, that's
true.
What she's saying.
Yeah.
We know Joe Biden got it was written out along with your answers.
I know.
Along with the answers.
Yeah. I mean, for somebody like the White House press secretary, you need not do that with her. I mean, his whole job is centered around speaking to the president and members of the cabinet and figuring out, okay, how am I going to – I know I'm going to get asked this. I may get asked this. I don't know if this is going to come up, but if it does, how do I respond?
So look at Sarah Huckabee Sanders, for example. The biggest challenge with her, Sean Spicer, and others would be, how do I answer in a way the president wants me to? But you never had to tell them what the subject is.
Yeah.
What are the problems with Social Security? What are the problems with immigration reform? What's the problem with the wall, the financing, the budget? You say to yourself, I know, but what does my boss want me to hear?
Yep. She's the voice of the president, so that's the job.
Right, and she's probably in on the brief. Like Jen Psaki reminds me of someone in on the briefings. So she kind of, without Joe Biden there. So like yeah. She's like, oh, let me just tell you this, and let me tell you the weakness of my argument. And so that's what we're used to.
I know.
And what I'm trying to verify, and I know you agree with me, is it doesn't matter what party it is. When you go to a press secretary, you know it's their job, but they have to give you something you can work with. She gave you nothing. The only thing I used on this show were questions because I wouldn't get the answer.
And it would just be a lot of, just I've been
questions.
Very clear.
Yeah, yeah.
She used that line a lot. We've been very clear. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Maybe she felt like she had no future recourse. I know that she wanted to do The View. There was reporting there.
Yeah, I
wonder what
happened.
Did you read that?
Yeah.
I know. And it just didn't work out for her. And given the position that she held, and I mean, she looks great on camera. You would think that maybe, but because of the weakness in terms of her delivery, it just never amounted into anything. So now she's writing this book.
More quality times with Carly Shimkus. By the way, when we get off the air, we have no relationship.
Zero.
Because she just uses our relationship to enhance your broadcasting career. Do you think that's true?
So mean.
Is that true?
No.
Okay, I didn't think so. Back in a moment.
Illuminating, intriguing, inculcating.
I know some of these words.
It's Brian Kilmeade. A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, Carly Shimkus is going to give me a few more quality minutes. But Carly, you were in New Jersey when we went on stage, History, Liberty, and Laughs, right?
Yes.
And what did you play? You were pregnant at the time.
Yes, I played...
That I think Hemings, Sally Hemings, right?
No. That was originally going to be my character, and we pivoted the character. I can't remember.
I think you walked in
Thomas Jefferson. Yes.
Yes. So you know how we bring these moments in history.
It's such a wonderful show. You do such
Thanks.
A good job.
So now we're up to seven different
wow.
skits, and it's History, Liberty, and Laughs. I'm going to be in Dayton, Ohio, June 21st. Go to Victoria Theater, and then August 23rd, this venue is way too big, 2,000 tickets. I don't know how I'm going to do that. Windspear Opera House, and then in September 27th, Richmond, Virginia, at Dominion Energy Center, the Carpenter Theater, that's September 27th, Richmond, Virginia. So we got radio affiliates in all of them.
That's
so
great.
Hopefully get a chance to see the listeners, but also this is year 250, celebrating 250.
I know, the 4th of July, and it's going to be incredible. Oh, wait, 250 for what?
Coming up this year. So now
yeah.
we're getting into that.
Oh, you looked at me like I had lobsters crawling out of my ears. Like,
really?
What? Yeah.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. This is how I look. I apologize. I'm sorry if I threw you.
It's a patriotic year is what you're saying. So all the more reason to celebrate the history that you bring to life in these shows. And I really like how you treat everybody that comes to the shows in the audience. You
right.
you give them special attention. And I mean, you have a really great thing going. And
really?
I was happy to be a part of it.
But Carly... You saying that, like, in the building with Fox people, I don't really have that attitude. It's more with the listeners and the viewers.
You do. You're just always so busy because you have so many things going on. Sometimes you just see, like, a streak of Brian running past you.
Is that true?
That's true.
Well, I apologize. I think that I've done that to you before.
But everybody loves you in and out of the building, Brian.
Oh, that's very nice.
I can confirm.
And by the way, so don't forget, One Nation Sunday night at 10 p.m. amongst my guests, Ben Shapiro and Mitch Daniels. Former CEO, former OMB director, and
yeah.
he ran Purdue.
Your show.
It is time to take the quiz.
It's five questions in less than 5 minutes. We ask people on the streets of New York City to play along. Let's see how you do.
Take the quiz every day at thequiz.fox. Then come back here to see how you did.
Thank you for taking the quiz.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.